Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good morning, or sorry, good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Suhag Shukla with us today to discuss the role of religious organizations in global conflict. She is Managing Director, Legal Counsel, and co-founder of the Hindu American Foundation, where she has helped launch the foundation as a leading voice for religious freedom. She is actively involved with Chimay Mission, has served on the board of the Nirvana Center, and is a member of the Faith-Based Security and Communications Advisory Committee for the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome, Suhag. Thanks very much for joining us today. It would be great if you could talk briefly about the role of U.S. faith-based organizations in global conflict and give us some instances of where these organizations have been working in relief work.
Well, thank you, Irina, and thank you to the Council on Foreign Relations and Amy and the outreach team for the opportunity to tackle this rather sensitive yet critical topic. But before I begin, I'd like to take a moment to remember and offer my prayers for the families of Ambassador Christopher Stevens and the three staffers who were killed last night. In the shadow of the attacks on U.S. interests in both Libya and Egypt and the stated motivating factors of the attackers, it's tragically apparent that conflicts globally are too often motivated by real and perceived grievances that are grounded in religious belief. And so I join all Americans in mourning the loss of our brave diplomats who stand on the front lines for our country every day. It's important for me to note at the outset that I and the Hindu American Foundation that I serve reject any argument that justifies violence to assuage wounded sentiments. I also cite the U.S. State Department's response to yesterday's attacks that, quote, the United States rejects efforts to denigrate the religious belief of others. This point, rejecting efforts to denigrate religious beliefs of others, indeed underlies my conversation today. And while the title of this talk is obviously very broad, the discussion here will not speak to the issues of radicalization and terrorism and the very real concerns elaborated elsewhere as to whether U.S.-based organizations are complicit with moral, financial, or logistical support. Rather, I'd like to focus our talk on a much more subtle concern. My offering today will focus on what is essentially the central goal of HAF's advocacy efforts, and that is to promote pluralism. We endorse the view of Professor Diane Eck of the Harvard Pluralism Project that pluralism entails recognizing difference in religious views while engaging in understanding. It also means, as a Hindu, what is well known in or said in the well-known Rig Vedic hymn, that the truth is one and the wise call it by many names. I'd like to explore what, in my opinion, are global practices that endanger this value, that actually reject pluralism and instead undergird a microcosm of conflict that sometimes explode in spasms of communally charged violence. Globalization, especially in the last few decades, has led to exponential growth in faith-based organizations providing much-needed humanitarian aid, including education, medicine, skills training, food, shelter, and emergency relief to parts of the world where the domestic governments may be unable or unwilling. And many faith-based organizations provide relief with no other agenda but to serve those that are in need. But others, and specifically I'm citing a vast number of evangelical or extreme right-wing institutions and churches from the U.S., the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, many European nations, and to some extent South Korea, actively engage in proselytization alongside relief work. It's this tactic, combining proselytization with aid, inspired from a sense of religious primacy, even supremacy, that I believe fosters inter- and interreligious tensions and conflict. Now, while historically the Islamic conquests, crusades, and colonialism changed religious geography, most often through forceful and violent means, globalization has fostered a far more stealth and at times military-like strategy among evangelical churches and organizations. And while these groups might peripherally provide humanitarian aid, they're primary and most actively engaged in evangelization, church planting, and international religious conversions. Collective campaigns such as the Joshua Project have mapped out large geographic regions to be targeted for this kind of outreach. And the regions that are most affected by an influx of American faith-based organizations is categorized as the 1040 window, or the quote-unquote resistance belt, and includes North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Now, these areas not only encompass the majority of the world's animist, Buddhist, Hindu, Jain, Sikh, Muslim, and primal and indigenous religious populations, but it also encompasses historically established Christian minority populations who are also targeted in these areas. An example of this are Coptic Christians in Egypt or Anglicans throughout sub-Saharan Africa who are targeted by U.S.-funded evangelicals. Now, rapid changes in religious demographics have wrought drastic changes in national, political, societal, and familial realities throughout these regions. And add to this the utilization of coercive methods and many times overt disrespect, denigration of indigenous religious traditions or objects and places of worship, and we really have a sure formula for creating a global religious tinderbox. Direct interference by U.S. faith-based organizations has also provided an avenue for the exportation of American culture war politics, the most well-known example being the push for legislating the death penalty for homosexuals in Uganda, which I'll get into later. Now, religious conflict driven by conversion is a serious concern, meriting, unfortunately, scant attention in the national consciousness. In fact, the issue thus far has been so cloaked in a very narrow construction of religious freedom that current international law, U.S. law, and U.S. foreign policy, some may argue, as I have often before, is inimical to what should be a universal value, which is religious pluralism. And indeed, the current interpretation of religious freedom in its unrelenting privileging of the freedom to convert fails to acknowledge what many pluralist adherents believe is as fundamental a human right, and that is the right to retain one's religion and to be free from interference or pressure to convert to another. And I submit two initiatives of the U.S. government which have perpetrated this asymmetrical view of religious freedom. First, the creation of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and the George W. Bush administration's expansion of faith-based initiatives. So first, a little bit about USERF. The commission, as many of you know, came into existence in 1998, and it was catalyzed by House Resolution 15 and Senate Concurrent Resolution 21, both of which focused exclusively on the, quote, persecution of Christians worldwide. Then there was sister legislation, the Wolf Specter, quote, Freedom and Religious Persecution Act, which also aligned with its earlier avatar's exclusive concern for Christians. And it wasn't until legislators smartened up and got a little politically correct and removed the exclusive focus that the act creating USERF passed, but not without heavy lobbying by international missionary organizations. The second portion of the U.S. government's participation in this asymmetry is the Bush administration's expanded faith-based initiative, which has continued under the Obama administration and initiated basically the flow of billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars into the coffers of faith-based aid agencies to provide social services not only abroad but at home with no external mechanism for oversight and really without any concern for fungibility of funds. So what we're going to be talking about today is indeed vast as it is complex. And so now that I've kind of provided a background, I'd like to focus my remarks on two major areas. First, I'd like to cover terminology in the financial context, at least for India, which is a region that I'm most familiar with. What do I mean by predatory proselytization? What are the differences between non-pluralist and pluralist traditions? And how much are we really talking about in terms of dollars? And the second major area that I'll cover is specific regions that are in the midst of interreligious tension and conflict, the source for which may be linked back to U.S. faith-based funding, presence, or interference. And again, the area that I'm most familiar with is India and the impact on Dharmic populations, but I will draw upon other well-known regions such as Haiti, Sri Lanka, and Uganda. And then we'll open the floor for discussion. So first, a little bit about terminology. What is predatory proselytization? And this is a coin that we termed at the Hindu American Foundation, and it's picked up a little bit with a citing of the term in the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom's latest report, as well in the media. And really, this term is to describe the tactics whereby vulnerable populations, we're talking about the poor, the sick, disaster-stricken, elderly, women, and children, who are targeted for conversion through coercive means, such as conditioning, access to jobs, healthcare, and education on conversion. It's making false promises that conversion will away from the native faith will somehow bring about healing, material opportunity, or overall betterment of one's social, psychological, or economic status. The next word or terminology that you'll hear a lot in our conversation is coerced, fraudulent, and unethical conversions. And for brevity, I'll just refer to this whole collection as unethical conversions. These are conversions that are the result of predatory proselytization. There are also conversions gained through tactics that overtly disrespect, denigrate, or demonize native traditions, or where objects and places of native worship are tampered with or vandalized in an effort to show their falsehood or inferiority. And then the last terminology that I'll go over, and it's a mouthful, is non-pluralist versus pluralist traditions and exclusivist versus non-exclusivist traditions. And while this might be an oversimplification, because as we know, every religious tradition has its spectrum, in every sense of the terminology, non-pluralist religions are generally diametrically opposed to traditionally pluralist religions. Non-pluralist religions often demand exclusive adherence, meaning conversion based on a claim that theirs is the only legitimate religion, so that non-pluralist traditions are generally exclusivist. In contrast, pluralist religious traditions, including most Dharmic, Eastern, and primal traditions, generally have a more expansive ethos that one's religious tradition may not be the exclusive source of truth, and which acknowledge the potential existence of multiple legitimate religious and spiritual paths. Most pluralist religious traditions are non-exclusivist, thus allowing for an assimilation of beliefs and traditions of another religion, but without requiring relinquishment of one's own religion or conversion to others. We see this manifest in some of the syncretic traditions through South America, Haiti, and other regions. Now I'll answer the question as to how much. And again, I drive home the point that my familiarity is with India and the impact on Dharmic populations. So I'll just give one example, and that is the government of India. And through its Foreign Contribution Regulation Act, which requires the collection of data on incoming foreign aid, the latest data that I had was the year 2007. And in 2007, the top two non-governmental donors to India were U.S.-based missionary organizations World Vision International, which contributed $155 million, that's about 10% of its annual budget that year, and Gospel for Asia at $99.5 million. Together, that's $255 million flowing into India in just a single year. What's really astonishing is the smaller organizations and the aid that's flowing into India. An astonishing 19,000 organizations in India, a disproportionate number linked to Christian missionaries, received donations totaling $2.4 billion in 2000 alone. And the inflow of private faith-based funding has grown rapidly. 2007 showed contributions that were more than double of that from 2002. So we're talking about billions of dollars that are able to change dramatically ground realities in India and elsewhere. Now let me get to some specific case studies. One of the most well-known and most recent examples is the tsunami in Sri Lanka. After the 2004 tsunami, the New York Times reported on American church groups who were very unapologetically combining desperately needed relief aid and proselytization. And I think what was most alarming for mainstream Americans and for the internationally was the targeting of children. There were special prayer meetings and activities that were targeted towards children, coloring Jesus pictures, read-aloud Bible sessions, and promises of being healed. There were prayer meetings with public healings and overtures, some subtle, some not so subtle, to the victims that the tsunami was somehow God's punishment for their not having accepted Jesus as their Savior. And most of the media that was on the ground reporting and talking to many of the locals found kind of a general sentiment that many locals were expressing fear that if they didn't convert, they wouldn't receive aid. So a tremendous amount of duress in a tragedy stricken population. What's interesting here, and I'll allude to it in other places as well, is the reaction from local Christian leaders who were angered by the predatory tactics of missionaries coming from abroad. They were afraid that they would exacerbate already previous underlying tensions between Sri Lanka's minority Christians and majority Buddhists, and more importantly, that these tactics would undermine grassroots interfaith cooperation that had emerged since the tsunami. Local Christian leadership called the actions of Americans unethical. And for well-established Christian aid groups like Catholic Relief Services, Lutheran World Relief, and others with religious affiliations who don't proselytize and who abide by the Red Cross guidelines that humanitarian aid not be used to further political religious purposes, they are the ones that bore the brunt of attacks because locals are not necessarily able to distinguish between those organizations that participate in predatory proselytization and those that do. I'll shift my focus now to India and in particular to Nagaland. There's a number of regions that I could cover, but in the interest of time, I'll only cover a few. Nagaland is a region where very real and violent conflicts began with the whole-scale conversion of the dominant Nagaland tribes at the turn of the century by British and then more aggressively over the last 50 years by American Baptist churches. So I cite a newsletter, a 1998 newsletter of the Baptist Peace Fellowship of North America, which implored its membership to endorse basically a seven-point statement from the Nagaland Baptist Church Council, a longtime partner of the American Baptist Board of International Ministries. So the statement, first of all, boasted of how, as a result of a unique history of American Baptist missionary work, Nagaland had become majority Baptist. We're talking about a whopping 75% of the 90% majority Christian state, when 18 years previously, meaning in the 1980s, Baptists made up only 30% of the population. The seven-point agenda was also endorsed by the banned separatist terror outfit, the National Socialist Council of Nagaland, which is the NSCN. The statement, coming from an American organization, also supported the boycotting of democratic elections in India, the only democratic government in that region, if you think about it in today's context, and the number of conflicts that are in that area, and the number of American interests that we have in that region. So essentially, we have American Baptist churches working aggressively to change the demography of an entire Indian state. Keep in mind that this state is about the size of Connecticut, robbing the tribes of their indigenous culture and traditions, and creating and supporting violent conflict between the secular government of India and the Baptist-supported NSCN. And then the Baptist Peace Fellowship in 1997 almost laughably calls for mediation talks of leaders of various political, religious, and social institutions in attempt to peacefully negotiate the internal conflict caused by them. And this meeting was held in Atlanta, Georgia. But even today, we have prominent American Baptist leaders, including the daughter of Reverend Billy Graham, Ann Graham Lotz, traveling to Nagaland without using the pulpit to condemn the often violent campaigns of the banned NSCN, and instead prominent American evangelicals such as Peter Sulak or Reed Trulson and Ann Graham again joined as recently as April 100,000 foreign delegates in a jubilee hosted in Nagaland. Now, I'll quickly just mention that Nagaland is also bordering a number of other Indian states, which have over the past few decades become Christian majority as a result of aggressive missionary work. And if we go to the Government of India's designated terrorism organizations, that is banned organizations, almost all of the terror outfits operating in Assam, in Manipur, in Nagaland, in Tripura are Christian. And while the information about funding for these Christian terror outfits is not available, the change in demography has really fostered an environment in which these groups have been able to form, and the change in demography is the result of private foreign missionary activity. But more importantly, this sort of interference is really a testament to the danger of conversion ideology that allows indigenous people to start seeing themselves as the other, which then sparks perceptions of alienation and ultimately separatism. And then undoubtedly, the grievances of the tribals are real, but the adoption of a separatist violence and terrorism obscures their real claims. I'll quickly shift to Uganda, where the past decade has really brought a disturbing spike in anti-gay violence, and a crisis which, according to Reverend Dr. Kapya Kaoma, an ordained Anglican priest and citizen of Zambia, and also a researcher on religion and sexuality for the Political Research Associates, is the result of the exportation of American culture wars by evangelicals. Uganda has witnessed unprecedented anti-gay violence, from the high-profile murder of gay rights activist David Soto and growing attacks which include beatings, public outings of homosexuals. This includes putting their private homes and addresses and information out in the public media, as well as the gang rape and rape of lesbians. Now, if we look at the anti-homosexuality bill that was introduced in fall and imposed not only the death penalty for certain homosexual acts, but also criminalized human rights advocacy on behalf of sexual minorities, it was really a direct outgrowth of a seminar that had occurred in March of that year. The co-sponsor of that conference was the Uganda-based Family Life Network, but this organization is funded by Christian right groups. And the Family Life Network partnered with two leading anti-gay activists from the States, and those two were Holocaust revisionist Scott Lively and Dan Scheimerer of the ex-gay group Exodus International. Rick Warren had also traveled to Uganda and to Rwanda and Kenya to talk about this particular issue, and basically declared very publicly to political leaders that homosexuality is not a natural way of life and thus not a human right. So when we look at the bill's language, it really is an outgrowth of this U.S.-funded conference. Now, there was obviously public outcry over the death penalty being imposed, and so Rick Warren and others did distance themselves from this legislation, but the violence has not stopped. And Reverend Kaoma says, and I think that this is very telling, that, quote, the influence of U.S. evangelical cultural warriors has been felt across sub-Saharan Africa. The Christian right has been involved in legislative or constitutional efforts to crack down on the LGBT populations of Kenya, Liberia, Namibia, Nigeria, Malawi, Rwanda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe as well. Uganda's anti-homosexuality bill has become a kind of template for other countries, including Nigeria and Liberia, where similar laws have been proposed. He also points out the irony of the evangelical imposition, given that during apartheid it was American mainline churches with more liberal views on social issues that supported the fight against South African apartheid and other colonial regimes, while it was many conservative U.S. evangelicals that insisted that anti-colonial leaders were godless and communists and terrorists. And lastly, I'll just quickly touch upon Haiti and the well-known cases that emerged out of relief efforts after the 2010 earthquake, where Baptist missionaries were caught as they tried to take 40 children from Haiti to Dominican Republic. In addition to that highly publicized case, it's important to note that 50% of Haiti are practitioners of a syncretic Haitian tradition known as voodoo, and voodoo believes in reincarnation, one god, and a pantheon of spirits. So after the earthquake, as many Haitians were gathering to partake in some of the voodoo rituals, it was members of smaller Christian aid groups who were reportedly harassing these Haitians who were, again, victims of this horrible natural disaster and were getting in the way of their being able to practice their tradition. Many voodoo practitioners also say that they converted to Christianity for fear that they would lose out on the aid, or were told by many missionaries that it was their participation in voodoo that had made God angry and caused the earthquake. So in light of the issues that I've highlighted here, the question that I pose for a greater discussion, and certainly not one that's going to begin that may begin here but will not end here, is what role should the U.S. government play in monitoring faith-based organizations providing international aid? While receipt of government funds requires faith-based organizations to refrain from using such funds to engage in proselytization, can it really be monitored or controlled? What, if any, role does the U.S. government have in regulating or monitoring private monies that flow internationally? What broader responsibility does the U.S. government hold when the activities of American faith-based organizations, whether at home, as we saw today, or abroad, create global conflict and impact U.S. foreign relations? And on an ethical level, what responsibility do mainstream Christians and other people of faith have in addressing this issue? So with that, Irina, I pass it off to you for questions.
Great. Thank you so much for that comprehensive overview and analysis. Let's turn it to the group for questions and comments.
Thank you. At this time, we open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the question queue, press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our first question comes from Sheikh Ubaid with the Muslim Peace Coalition.
For taking my question, I'm with Muslim Peace Coalition and also with Coalition Against Genocide that was instrumental in getting the visa of Narendra Modi revoked, who was behind the pogrom of thousands of Muslims in Gujarat. The presentation talks about the conversion of mostly non-Christian to Christians, but most of the Hindu population that we are talking about, the tribals, were forcibly at one time or other converted to Hinduism, especially when they had become Buddhist. Hinduism also was spread by conversion to Southeast Asia. So this differentiation between religions that do conversion and not is a little confusing here. Maybe, I do not know how much of this presentation was swayed by the speaker's affiliation with Hindu America Foundation, which supports, extremist organizations like World Hindu Council, Vishwa Hindu Parishad, and all of these organizations were exposed by the research work that our Coalition Against Genocide did. So I'm a little disappointed that it was very one-sided. And if Christianity would have spread by force, then when the Britishers were ruling India, they could have done it. I mean, these people want to adopt a religion of their own free will and let them do that. I mean, they should not be forced. They should not be bribed. But at the and many of these people convert to Islam, which is not a dominant religion in India, which is being persecuted. So that shows that many of these tribals actually want to convert to either Islam or Christianity.
Thank you. But
I could just make a comment there. The presentation that I've made here has nothing to do with necessarily a conversion that's out of genuine faith, out of a religious experience. That's not what we're trying to, that's not what I'm trying to bring up here. What I'm talking about is when we combine proselytization and conversionary methodology or seeking conversions And conditioning that on aid is where we need to be mindful as members of civil society as to what impact that might have. And in terms of any affiliation with any extremist organizations, I think I can stand on the record of the Hindu American Foundation of having reached across the aisle and worked with organizations of all faith backgrounds, and I'm sure that there's many that would attest to the fact that we are a progressive organization that is willing to dialogue and willing to find our shared issues of concern.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Anju Margava with the Hindu American Civil Charity.
Thank you, Suhag and Irene, for bringing this very important issue to the forefront. And I commend HAF for the research and for providing this perspective and opening a much greater dialogue on this with different constituencies, because these are issues which one group cannot really address. It really has to be addressed on with much, much broader perspective in terms of looking at the impact and the lenses with which many different stakeholders look at this issue, and it's really important to bring this voice also on the public platform. I just wanted to mention that that I think that the U.S. government, from what I have seen, does play a role in monitoring what is being done, and I think that to some extent there is, especially in the U.S., a lot of monitoring that gets done in keeping a separation between the use of funds for proselytization government funds cannot be used for that, is what I have understood. And certainly overseas, to the extent that it can be improved and the monitoring be done, that I think those are things that can be discussed further. And I think that I would just encourage this kind of a dialogue to continue with many different stakeholders to see what the issues are on and how it plays out on the global platform. So my question is, in terms of the funding that has been seen being monitored, being used, what the impact of that would be, that would be something that would need to be addressed and in information provided to the government and other stakeholders.
Well, I think in the case of funding, it is complicated. From the best of my understanding, the whole aspect of whether U.S. government funding is being used for proselytization or in aid that's connected with that is depends a lot on self-monitoring. And so it's as good as, you know, someone says, and we have to take people's word for it. But from a lot of anecdotal things, instances that we're hearing from the ground, it's difficult to ascertain what's occurring, at least in the United States, for instance. And this is, I cite this example because it's one that I'm familiar with. Bhutanese refugees, for instance, they are Hindu minority who were pushed out of Bhutan and were living in refugee camps in Nepal, and just recently are being brought to the United States as refugees. And a number of them are receiving social services from faith-based organizations. But so the services that they're receiving are fairly clear-cut, that they're secular and there is no proselytization that's occurring at that time. It's what happens after hours. You know, when the person who was teaching you how to speak English then comes with his church to your community and says, hey, we're going to have a prayer meeting and we're going to do a Bible reading. And all of a sudden you've put a person in a situation where they are afraid to not attend because they feel that perhaps placement for jobs or whatever services that they're desperately in need of might be jeopardized.
Thank you. Next question.
Here, our next question comes from Amaz Corbett with the Church of Jesus Christ.
I wanted to thank Suhag and your colleague Mihir for your thoughtful participation in this and other CFR activities. Appreciate always the Hindu American Foundation's openness and progressiveness, as you indicated before. I think what might be helpful, though, in addition to what you've said, Suhag, is to add some examples of when humanitarian outreach is done correctly. And I know I know that in the past I've shared at least an instance where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints actually provided copies of the Quran to Muslim communities where they were providing humanitarian help. It seems to me that that kind of outreach, you know, might be cited as a way to go about humanitarian outreach to make sure that it's completely separated from any attempts to proselytize. What do you think about that?
I couldn't agree with you more, and thank you for reminding me of that example that you did share with us this summer. And that really is such a perfect example of faith in action, taking the teachings and without imposing them on the recipient, and really just demonstrating the value of selfless service. And I kind of touched upon this earlier, but the unfortunate fact is that instances like that, and they may be the majority of the kind of services that are being provided, the type of humanitarian aid that is being provided, but it gets overshadowed by the more aggressive efforts. And I'll give you an example of one particular case that I'm familiar with. This is the story of the apartment watchman of one of our executive council members' family, and they are in Hyderabad, India. So when this watchman's young daughter was ill, they obtained medical assistance through the local church. And the assistance from this church, which has ties to the U.S., came with strings attached. They were asked to convert. And not having any other means to obtain treatment for their daughter, they complied. And then their daughter did get better. But the church continued to come over, and every Christmas season they'd be there to make sure that the family was still Christian. And the family had to make sure that they had the visible symbol of a lit star hung over their home. But the wife continued to wear her traditional sari and a mangal sutra, which is the Hindu symbol of marriage, and a red mark that is also on her forehead, which is also a symbol, a Hindu symbol for marriage and auspiciousness and reminding us of our spiritual third eye. But her daughters now have begun to wear Western clothing, and they're seeking to be more like the Christian Christians who converted them. Now, the family still uses their Hindu names because they haven't been baptized. But that's a question of not whether they will be, but it's when they will be. And the pressure is really on if they want additional benefits enjoyed by their neighbor, Naomi, for instance, who has been baptized. They'll have to completely abandon their names, the festivities that link their community together, and all the practices that they've known since childhood, even their understanding of the big questions in life. And so for now, the family participates kind of quietly and surreptitiously in the neighborhood celebrations of major Hindu holidays such as Ganesh Chaturthi or Dashera. But Naomi, the individual and their friend who has been baptized, doesn't even try. In order for her to receive her monthly allowance, she has to receive visits from the church people to ensure she hasn't strayed from the Christian path. And she's not allowed to get involved in the Hindu festivities with her neighbors and friends. So while I commend the efforts of many faith-based organizations and people of faith who are providing humanitarian aid in a selfless manner and with full respect of the recipient's situation and their background, it's these instances that are creating the conflicts that we need to be worried about.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ram Deslam with the University of Hawaii.
Hi, thank you. First of all, Suhaag, that was a great presentation. I appreciate it, and I like a lot of, I'm very consistent with much of what you said. I have to question what the Muslim gentleman's comment. As a scholar, somebody that I look at the issue of conversion and change throughout the years and throughout the centuries in India. I've been working in Central India for many decades. And his comment that many of the tribals, that what you're really talking about is tribals, and that many of the tribals were forced converted from Buddhism, there's no scholarly information that would validate that at all. That's, it may be his opinion, but it doesn't have any scholarly basis. As far as the issue of forced conversions, it's still a process. I see it regularly. I've been seeing it for more than 30, 35 years in Central India, and it's centered around either education, money, or health. And it's the example you gave of the woman who the family converted because of the illness of their daughter. I've seen that happen in so many cases where Christian missionaries have basically said, if you don't convert, you don't get the medicine, or this is what it's going to cost. And they know that the cost is far more than what the family can afford, and they know that out of their love for their offspring or their children or the member of the family, they'll convert in order to get the medicine. And that's really sad, and that's a continuing process. It is going on. There are groups, as you have mentioned and as others have mentioned, that are legitimate. And that's great, but the problem is that there are many, many that are not, and that practice using the guise of social welfare as a means of forcing conversion. And because I'm not Indian, when I go there a lot of times and I meet missionaries, they assume that I'm Christian and they assume that I'm there for the same purpose. And I'll ask them kind of the methods that they're using, and they will tell me about all the devious methods that they're able to use to get people to convert. And it is a very sad situation. That's all. I just wanted to make a comment.
Thank you very much. So do you want to respond, or should we go to the next question?
We can go to the next question. But thank you for your sharing your experiences.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Aveen Farooqi with the Islamic Center of Rockland.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. it was a pleasure to hear your presentation, Suhaag, and it is excellent, and I congratulate you on not only the content, but the examples that you are providing about. I am here from the Islamic Center of Rockland in New York, and we had recently conducted our first meeting, interfaith meeting, and it's now proceeding to the second session, which is being held at the Grace Church in New York and so on. First of all, let me also strongly condemn what happened in Libya and Egypt, and I fully agree with you what your earlier comments about the tragedies that's happening. I am thoroughly familiar with what you are talking about because some of my dads, when I was in high school, my best friends were Brahmins, and I grew up in India, and I know the work of how the Christian missionaries did. In fact, we have a couple of friends here in Rockland from Kerala who have now the Christian names. So, but I think my question was basically about the faith-based organizations. It appears from your presentation that at least in the U.S., that means only a certain religion, is it?
Well, I don't have information in terms of faith-based organizations that have the kind of focus internationally. Certainly, there are Hindu organizations, Buddhist organizations, and Muslim organizations that are providing services abroad, but we don't see the Joshua projects that are bringing together not just large world relief organizations, but really galvanizing smaller churches with an agenda that is changing religious demography. And along with the change of religious demography is a change in values. And when you have changes in values of not everyone in a particular society, but certain segments, then that's leading to global conflict. If there is that sort of concerted effort in other religious communities, I would be very open to learning about it. But we're talking about predatory proselytization and its destructive influence.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Doran Coyle with Solar Cross Temple.
Hi. Thanks so much. Thank you for this well-thought-out talk, Sue Hogg. When I was reading about the events in Libya and Cairo, religious pluralism was at the forefront of my thoughts, and I had been wondering how the global interfaith community might help keep such situations from occurring. To address your talk a little bit more, I also work with Martin DePora's House of Hospitality and the Interfaith Tent for Justice in Oakland, California. And as a pagan minister, I've directly seen the impact of predatory proselytization on the homeless population in California. So close to home, I feel I can address this directly and try to bring a more pluralistic view to conversations and to the work of offering aid and working for justice. But on a larger scale, it seems to me that this conversation needs to start even before your questions about looking at funding. I agree that that's a really important question. You know, if people are getting, if these organizations are getting money from the U.S. government, what sort of accountability do they have? We do need to keep on top of that. But I also feel the conversation for me needs to begin with looking at how to foster a more clear dialogue between what you're naming the non-pluralist and pluralist religions. And I would love to see further discussion and idea sharing on how we might move forward with this. And I wonder if you have any ideas to start us off.
Well, I think you make a really important point about those dialogues needing to occur even before we delve into the kind of geopolitical impact of this issue. And, you know, I think getting engaged at the local level is obviously very important. I think for those people who are committed to pluralism, I think that there's an onus on us to explain what we mean by religious pluralism. I think that there's sometimes a misunderstanding that religious pluralism means that all religions are equal, and that makes people uncomfortable. And I kind of alluded to it earlier, but really religious pluralism, if we look at the way the Pluralism Project has defined it, it's about the acknowledgement of other religious traditions and really kind of engaging in dialogue or working together on issues of shared concern that bring about a better understanding of not only our shared values, but our differences. At the Hindu American Foundation, and that's obviously what I'm most familiar with, but there are historical reasons as to why Hindus might have baggage with the Muslim community, that there might be baggage with the Christian community. So how do you even get past all that baggage to begin a conversation? And the methodology that we've utilized is finding issues that are not controversial or finding issues that we do have common goals in, whether it's domestically the separation of church and state or fighting for free exercise, or internationally if it's talking about human rights for a particular minority that's affected. Finding those type of platforms that are shared is certainly a way in which you can begin the conversation, but also to making sure that we communicate that religious pluralism does not force someone to accept another religion. It only asks that they respect another religion.
Can I follow up for a moment?
Sure.
I agree with all of that, and I certainly do work with groups that have all of that in mind. You know, I work with Christians and Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and even atheists on these issues. Where I fall down, however, and where I have difficulty is in trying to do this work with people who have that supremacist ideology. you know, that ideology of religious supremacy that you talked about early on. And I feel like together we need to come up with resources for how to deal with that sort of ideology. And I don't know what the answer is to that.
Well, we can work together on that, and hopefully we'll find something sooner than later.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ananti Rambachan with the St. Olaf College.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you, Suhag. I have two comments that I wanted to make. The first is, I think the issue of predatory or aid conversion, in some ways, it's also very a tragic element to it from the perspective of the religions themselves. I think that when, of course, when state funds are used, I think the state has to exercise some kind of oversight and some kind of determination of how the funds are going to be used. But at the same time, this is a matter that I think is also particularly to be dealt with by the religious traditions themselves, because, you know, predatory or unethical conversion in some ways undermines the very nature of religious conviction, which is that it is not meaningful unless it is voluntarily embraced and professed. This goes to the very heart of what it means to be a religious person, which is to embrace a worldview voluntarily. So that I think it's important that the religious traditions see this also as undermining significantly what traditions claim to be at the very heart of religious commitment. And one would hope that that the traditions themselves will begin to address it. We've seen some commendable moves, you know, by the Vatican and also the World Council of Churches to develop ethical standards. They may not be adequate, and they may not satisfy all that we from other traditions would like to see. But we are seeing some hopeful signs there, which I think are to be encouraged. And my second point is that one of the ways in which the issue of aid may be appropriately handled, I think that we also need to commend, you know, good efforts to relieve communities where poverty exists or where there is illiteracy. And religious traditions have always felt that they needed to be active in the alleviation of human suffering. But I think that what is necessary now is that in communities of diversity, all of these measures should have a sort of an inter-religious focus. In other words, if you want to work in a particular community, which is a diverse community, you should reach out to people of other traditions. And this should be a collaborative, a dialogical effort, which might go a long way in allaying fears and suspicions and misunderstandings. Because if the object is, you know, the alleviation of poverty by providing learning, education, healthcare, there should be no reluctance to cooperate with people of other religious traditions in the achievement of those ends. And I hope that, you know, religious traditions would move more in that kind of direction.
You know, I think you're exactly right. Another example to add to the two that you gave is the Episcopalian Church, which a few years ago issued an apology for the years of aggressive missionary activity and the conversions. And those are the types of positive steps that are coming out of mainstream Christianity, that, you know, we're in a multi-religious world, and we're going to have to figure out how we're going to get along and how we're going to live together. And it's unfortunate that it is the actions of a few that are outweighing the very good works that are coming out of Christian charities. Unfortunately, those very few happen to also be very well funded, and that's where this asymmetry of power comes into play. And I know we're running low on time, and I would just like to bring up one other point, and that is going back to how do we even begin the conversation amongst pluralist traditions. And I think one place is also in looking at international law. The Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, this is all, these are all laws that are put in place to provide a framework for religious freedom. But unfortunately, the Declaration and other international law only acknowledge the right to freedom of religion and the right to change religion, but make no mention of a right to retain one's religion or to be free from force, fraud, harassment, intimidation, exploitation, or the conditioning of humanitarian aid. These are all points that need to be part of the dialogue when we're talking about religious freedom, if we're to create an environment in which religious freedom is truly a right that reflects all of humanity, regardless of what tradition you come from.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Saeed, Columbia University.
Okay, good afternoon, and thank you very much both to the CFR and to you for bringing this conference to, you know, have some impact on the discussions that already have been taking place. I want to really recognize the point that you just made in terms of the United Nations and its provisions for freedom of expression and freedom of people to either practice their own faith or to have a freedom of conscience. While we are talking about these coercive and other methods of trying to have people to convert to whatever faith, we need to recognize that these kinds of approaches exist probably in all faith groups, and tendency to coerce people to either remain in the same faith or adopt another faith will always be there. I mean, I think what needs to happen that people like you and you know, I mean, other organizations will have to take the route that you just pointed out in your final comment of not only respecting other faiths, but also have an environment in which you know, I mean, freedom of thinking is emphasized more than the needs that people might have, either in terms of money or in terms of medicine or whatever, as the routes that should be taken for human upliftment. So I just wanted to say that, and I think we need to sort of pursue these goals irrespective of the oppositions that might, you know, emerge or we might face in the process of bringing this kind of freedom of thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Suhag, you want to take that before we wrap up?
I just wanted to thank you again, Irina, and Council on Foreign Relations for providing a platform really before the people who have the potential to make a change and to impact this very crucial and critical issue. I think the events of yesterday demonstrate the need for people of faith and for faith-based organizations to voice our concerns when faith actors act badly and to support those faith actors who are living out really the best ideals of what religion has to offer. And so with that, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Suhag, for your presentation today, and for to all of you for your valuable questions and comments on this important topic. We appreciate it. This conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, in which we seek to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars from across the country in cross-denominational conversations on a broad range of international issues. So we have a very broad landscape to cover, and we hope that we will represent lots of different points of view. Our next call will take place on Thursday, October 18th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Ahmed Corbett, Director of the New York Office of Public and International Affairs for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, will talk about what has been referred to in the media as the Mormon moment. So I hope you will join us for that call. We'll send out an invitation under separate cover. And I just remind you to visit our website and our special portal for religious leaders and scholars at cfr.org/religion. So thank you again, and thank you, Suhag, for today's call.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.